There we go. Okay. Could I get two of you to pray for our time this morning, and we'll get going, okay?
Dear Heavenly Father, I want to thank you for waking us up this morning. I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to come and read your word and just dwell together. I pray that you allow your Holy Spirit to enter this place as we study and we learn and we are somehow transformed into the likeness of your image. I thank you for all these people. I pray that you continue to bless their lives and allow our fellowship to speak to one another vividly so that we may grow in your light. I thank you for all that you do. And in your son's name, Jesus, I pray.
Yeah, God, thank you for a day that we can wake up and spend time together learning about your people, learning about you working through your people and the goings on of that. Would you help Rick wake up this morning and guide us well and lead us well? And would you allow us to be attentive and help us to be able to listen and hear from you this morning? We love you, Lord, in your name. Amen.
Amen. Very good. Well, what we're going to do today is we're really not going to get into the scriptures directly like you're normally doing in Genesis right now. You are in Genesis 12, is that right?
Sure.
Is that how far you've gotten with Mike? Somewhere in that?
Nine.
Just finished what?
Ten.
Noah just passed away.
Okay. Okay. Some of you still have Noah alive, huh? And some of when you get to the very end of chapter 11, so very shortly, I don't know if that'll be tomorrow or knowing Mike, that could be in a month from now. But and I say that affectionately. I love Mike. You're going to get to chapter at the end of chapter 11, beginning of chapter 12. Who is introduced to us at the end of chapter 11 that becomes the focal point from chapters 12 through 25?
Abraham.
Okay. Abram, who becomes Abraham. He's introduced at the very end of chapter 11. Beginning in chapter 12 through 25, he's the focal point. So that rest of that first half of the book of Genesis. Just as a side note, there are a couple of chapters that focus a little bit on Isaac, his son. But most of the second half of the book of Genesis is focused on who?
Joseph.
Joseph? No. It's the lifetime of Jacob, who is the father of Israel, the nation. Okay, so if you look at chapter 27 all the way through chapter 49, Jacob. Now, he has a son named Joseph, and we see some stories about Joseph in there. But the real focal point when you get to chapter 49 is Jacob giving a prophetic message about each of the 12 sons and speaking about them prophetically and everything. And then he passes. So, but anyway, going back, I digress. When you get to the end of chapter 11, you see Abraham introduced. And the question becomes, where does this guy come from? Because he was not born and raised in Israel at all. He was born and raised and lived a major portion of his life till he was 75 years old. He lived in modern day southeast Iraq in a city called Ur. And we want to look at where did he come from? Where did Abraham and Sarah come from? Where did they spend their the first part of their life, growing up and learning about life and learning a lot of things. What was life like for them there? So we're going to be looking at what was called then ancient Mesopotamia. And that is what is on that map, on that sheet that I gave you, the handout I gave you, is a map of ancient Mesopotamia. I want you to look at a few things on that map with me right now. If you'll notice, down in the far bottom right corner is the Persian Gulf. Okay? Notice from the Persian Gulf coming up, there is a dotted line, a dotted blue line, that has around an ancient coastline, question mark. From all that we can tell, there's not a question whether or not there was an ancient coastline that went further up. The question mark is this exactly where it was? But there was the Persian Gulf has filled in with silt and that sort of thing from the two main rivers that feed into it at this point over time. Much the same way as the Mississippi Delta is at New Orleans, basically, is filling in with silt over years of the Mississippi River, bringing stuff down the river. That's what over a couple of millennia, a couple thousand years, that area filled in quite a bit. And it's been a lot longer than that now. But there was this ancient coastline, and if you'll notice, at the very northwest tip, there's a little city there called Ur. Can you see that? You might want to circle that or something, because that is where Abraham is from. Abraham and Sarah are from Ur.
You are. Say Abraham and
Sarah, his wife. Now then, two other things I want you to notice are, can you see a cod on the top left-hand corner in large and capital letters, a cod, A-K-K-A-D? You may have heard of the language Akkadian. It's the language of the Akkad people. Notice in the middle of the page in capital letters, Sumer, S-U-M-E-R. Can you see that?
Yes.
Notice to the right on the map in capital letters, Elam, E-L-A-M. Those are, Akkad, Sumer, and Elam are descendants of Shem. You're studying Noah. Okay, Shem, Ham, Japheth. These are descendants of Shem. And this is the area where the descendants of Shem settled.
In all three of those areas?
All three of those areas. Okay. You'll notice as well, if you look at Sumer again, there in the middle of the page, above it, it says the R Tigris, that's the river Tigris. And notice to the left of it, the R Euphrates, that's the Euphrates River. The Tigris and Euphrates rivers came down, the Tigris River, they go all the way up into modern day Turkey, and they come down from the mountains up there all the way down to the Persian Gulf eventually and feed into that. And those are the rivers that carried the silt eventually down and started filling in the delta there of the Persian Gulf. I'm just trying to give you a lay of the land, because some of these places and peoples and the rivers are going, we're going to keep talking about those this morning, because they're very important to understand all this. So can you see how the Tigris and Euphrates River move from the bottom right-hand corner, basically, of the map all the way up to the north part of the map? They just sort of wind all the way up the top part of the map. The land in between them was known as Mesopotamia, which means land between the rivers. Okay, if you've ever heard of ancient Mesopotamia or talked about that, it just means land between the rivers.
Didn't they teach us like something about Mesopotamia in school when we were kids?
Yes.
It's the same as the Fertile Crescent, right?
It's the very bottom right portion of the, yeah. Is that the same as the Fertile Crescent?
Yeah.
The Fertile Crescent followed the Tigris and Euphrates rivers up to the north into Turkey and then went down into modern-day Lebanon and Israel. So it made this big, that was called a crescent, the Fertile Crescent. It made this big arch from where we're looking at right now all the way up. It was very fertile. A lot of it fed by the rivers that were there. Which is, when you see that, when you get into Genesis 12 and following, where you see Abraham and his father and his nephew and his wife leaving Ur and going to a land that God would show him, when they leave, they follow the Fertile Crescent. They go north up to Haran eventually as part of that Fertile Crescent. They follow the rivers and then they come back down into modern day Israel. At least not the father, but the rest of the clan came down that way. In many ways, you would have studied about ancient Mesopotamia because it is the birthplace of civilizations. We have archaeological digs that have uncovered documents that go back 4,000 years before Christ. So over 6,000 years ago, we have documents from that period. We have unearthed libraries. We have unearthed schoolhouses with their texts and everything. We have a phenomenal amount of information from this area. And what we want to talk about today will point out a lot of that and help us learn from some of the resources that have been unearthed over there. By the way, just to bring it down to modern day history, when you hear about ISIS destroying things over there, some of the things they're destroying are the very things we're talking about. It's heartbreaking to me to see such valuable information and resources just in a matter of moments being destroyed and everything. So anyway. Look back at your map for just a second, and then we'll move on.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I don't understand that. So are they like going to places that have already been unearthed and then just destroying those places, or are they like unearthing things themselves and destroying them?
They're not unearthing things. They're destroying what has been discovered, sites.
Got it.
For instance, and this doesn't relate to this one specifically, but up near Mosul, in the very north part of Iraq. Mosul is the remnant of what is left of the ancient capital of Assyria, of the Assyrians, where Noah went. Remember, where did God want Noah to go? Where did God want Jonah to go? To Nineveh. Mosul is the remnant of ancient Nineveh. Okay. And right outside of Mosul is what is, there's a large foothill mound of, and that sort of thing. It's probably 500-600 feet high. It's a good size mound outside of Mosul, and it's referred to as, and has been for centuries now, as Jonah's tomb. And they have unearthed a lot of that ancient day stuff there, and all that was destroyed. So they'll go into archaeological digs, things that have been unearthed, things that have been discovered, things that have been taken out and put in museums or libraries or whatever, and those will be destroyed. And so it's really sad to me. But anyway. Back to the map real quick.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
very
good. Thank you. So look at Akkad, Sumer, and Elam again. Those three groups of peoples that were descendants of Shem. The Akkadians to the north will eventually become the part of the Assyrian Empire that will go in and destroy the northern part of Israel and take it captive and everything. The Elamites, that is in mostly modern-day Iran, western Iran today, they're on the right side of your map. Both the Akkadians and the Elamites became very warring people. So all these cities that you see listed here on this map were what was called a city-state. It was its own, it wasn't part of a country. It was its own identity. It had its own king. It had its own laws. In many cases, it would have its own religions and everything. But it was its own entity. It didn't belong to anything else or anything. It was just its own little country as a city. They were not under anyone else's authority. And a lot of these city-states in Akkadia and in Elam were more warring kind of people. Their idea of getting ahead or success was to go capture another city-state and take over that city-state and take the wealth of that city-state back to their little city-state, back to their city, their village. And if you have followed anything at all in the last 10, 12 years of what's going on in this part of the world, when you hear things about further to the east, Afghanistan, a lot of things are happening there today that were happening back then in terms of, you'll hear them referred to as warlords now. But they are powerful individuals who have control, and they're constantly battling. These warlords are constantly battling. That's what it was like back then in Akkadia and in Elam. But in Sumer, it was not that way so much. The Sumerians were much more of a engineering kind of people. They, instead of going and taking what other people had and bringing it back to them, they created new things. And we're going to talk about some of that. And that's where Ur is at. In the period of time that we want to look at, 2100 to 1900 BC, so say roughly 2000 BC, was what is known as the Ur III dynasty. The Ur III dynasty. It was the largest, most influential period in ancient Mesopotamia. So many advances were made there. Ur 3 is called. There were two other dynasties of the city of Ur as a city-state, but this is the Ur 3 dynasty. This is the period of time when Abraham and Sarah were born and raised in Ur, okay, during this heyday. Now, we're going to talk some more about that. Turn your page. So the land of the Sumerians there, number two, that's called, again, Mesopotamia, between the rivers, land between the rivers. The rivers would, just a little bit about the land, what they experienced weather-wise and everything is very similar to what we experience here in the Central Valley. This was basically a desert in the sense that it was dry. It was not uncommon for it to be extremely hot there. They really didn't have, and still don't, have summer, winter, fall, and spring like you would see normally in a lot of places in the world. What they had was a hot summer, not so hot summer, summer, not so hot summer. I mean, that's sort of their seasons over there. It never really got that bad. The only thing they had that was different than that was in what we would call winter time, it would be the rainy season for them, much as it is in Central and South America. They don't talk about summer and winter. They talk about rainy season and dry season and that sort of thing. And so they would have a rainy season very similar to what we would have. We just don't get the rain. But we have a rainy season. But they would get very little rain, and it would all be concentrated in a 2 to 3 month period, in the period of time we would call winter. And they would get rain during that period of time. The rivers weren't used to that. They didn't have dams and all those kind of things to control water. So whenever it would start raining during that rainy season, the rivers would flood. So when you're reading through your Old Testament history this semester with Mike, you're going to start seeing later on about the kings from Assyria who would make another campaign. They would start another warring time with the going toward modern day Israel. They would go to hit Lebanon and Jordan and those areas, and then go on down further south. What were they waiting for? Why didn't they just keep on going? Because they had to get home before the rainy season, or they couldn't get across the rivers. And they had to wait until after the rainy season to go back again. So there would be seasonal periods. Even when you study about David and the story of David and Bathsheba, it starts off by saying when it was time for kings to go out to war. That's after the rainy season. That's when kings would go back out to war, was after the rainy seasons. So anyway, that's something that Mesopotamia. So here they have virtually no rainfall, very similar to what we have here today where we live. Very little rainfall. And yet they were able to raise tremendous crops. They exported food to other places along with some other natural resources they had, but they exported food. They took care of themselves quite well. How did they do that? You know how we have canals and how we have channeled water out of the mountains to come down here? Guess what they did? Guess who invented that? I went through this in great detail a few years ago in residency. That went into a lot of that, and one of the guys came up to me who was a farming major at Fresno State and had grown up in a farm all of his life, and he said, all the things you just talked about are the things we're still doing today. Have you ever heard of a farmer's almanac? Guess where that started? Ancient Mesopotamia. Because they had records for thousands of years.
What is that?
A farmer's almanac. What they would do was they would go back, they could go back and look at weather patterns. And they could predict with tremendous success overall what seasonal kind of things were going to be like this year based upon the last, we talk about the last 100-year records in America today. They're looking at a couple thousand years of records. Okay? And they could see all kinds of trends that would develop and how long they would last, generally speaking, etc. I'll get into more of that a little bit later on. They got anywhere from 2 to 10 inches of rain a year. Sound familiar? That's our average here over time is 9 inches here in the valley. But they invented irrigation, dikes, levees, canals, all of that to channel water and to get it where they wanted it, when they wanted it during that rainy season so they could use it later on. Get the picture once again, because it's going to be important as you go through Genesis. Abraham was raised in a very arid, hot, desert kind of area. Okay? And why do I say that's important for Abraham? Where does Abraham end up settling for most of his life when he moves to Israel?
In
the valley of Lush. No. Good. He's there for a while. What becomes home? Where are Isaac and Jacob born and raised? In Beersheba, the furthest south city, the furthest city into the desert in Israel. You've got all the lush land from north of Jerusalem all the way up. And Abraham came down and he stayed in some of those areas, but he kept going south and ended up settling for most of his life in Beersheba, the further southern city, farthest into the desert. Why? It's home. Felt like home. That's where he, that kind of place he was from. He knew how to live there and survive there. And probably land was cheap there. Because nobody else wanted to live there. But he knew how to live there. He had grown up in that. And we'll see some more about that. Okay, number three there, the history of the Sumerians. their history, the documents we have unearthed there in Sumer particularly, have all those documents are basically categorized into three areas. Before the flood, and after the flood. Okay.
Is that a distinction that we make, or do the documents refer to a flood happening?
The documents themselves refer to, like king, we'll talk about a king list, the Sumerian king list. And it will talk about these were the kings before the flood, etc. And it would talk about how long they lived and all that. Interestingly, they lived a lot longer before the flood than they did after the flood in their king list. And secular historians who don't believe in the scriptures and don't believe in God will talk about, well, those are just exaggerations that he was a king for 400 years and everything. Nobody could do that and everything. But if they're exaggerating, why did they stop exaggerating after the flood? And they didn't live for 400, you know, become kings for 400 years anymore. And you see the ages and the length of time they reigned decreasing after the flood, just like you do in the Bible. Yes. I don't know if they were documents that survived the flood in the, but they are documents that make record of things before the flood.
How is that possible?
Because some people survived the flood.
How is that possible?
Huh?
No, we are not talking about Noah.
Yes.
You are talking about Noah.
Didn't Noah and his wife and sons and their wives survive the flood? Shem was the father of this area.
So if he had told, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and so now there is a recording of these were the kings before and how long they lived and that sort of thing. Yeah, interestingly. We have, I've talked about, we have 40,000 documents from ancient Mesopotamia. I'm talking about before 2000 BC. Okay, 40,000 documents that we've unearthed there that we can learn from. We have 15 different king lists that give us lists of kings from this period of time, from that ancient period of time before the flood, different ones of them. All 15 of those before the flood king lists end with these words, and the flood swept over the earth. So they would have a list of kings and what their names were, some of their accomplishments, how long they reigned as king, and that sort of thing, and it would end with, and the flood swept over the earth, over and over again. And these were kings from different city-states in that area, not just in one area, but all of that.
Would people sometimes misinterpret that as multiple floods? Or is it like, or is it like a list of all the kings, and then like a nice little book end at the end of all of it says a flood swept over the earth?
Well, there would be a list of different kings.
Yeah.
The list of kings for this particular city. If you look at your map there, so let's say Eridu, just to the southwest a little bit of Eridu, there's a list of kings from Eridu. And how long they reigned, etc., some of their accomplishments. And that list of kings ends with, and the flood swept over the earth.
Okay.
And then you have another king list from another city.
Okay.
And all their ancient kings, and the earth, and the flood swept over the earth.
Do those in those times match up?
Yes.
From each, from different cities?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Then there are flood stories themselves. We have the Gilgamesh tablets, especially Gilgamesh Tablet 2, it's called, is a flood story that talks about the ancient flood that we have a record of. I'm sorry?
What people group that original from?
The Gilgamesh tablets?
Where did that story come from?
From the Sumerians. Yes. Yeah. They were descendants of Shem. Yeah. And that's in this area. Just as a side note, we have over 200 flood stories from around the world that all date within 100 years of each other. And I'm talking about from far South America to far northeastern Russia. We have flood stories from all over the world, over 200 of them, that all date within 100 years of each other. And in terms of when they were written, not 100 years variance of when they thought the flood was, but 100 years, they were written within 100 years of each other, the best way we can identify the dating of documents and everything.
Sorry, I guess I'm just confused because I thought the flood wiped out humanity, or was it just all sin? I don't get it. How are people aware and left behind?
How were people aware and left behind?
Yeah, if there was only
the people on the boat. I mean, based upon what you've seen in Noah, after the flood, there were only 8 people alive, and they and their descendants spread throughout the whole world.
Oh, so you're saying like world, like trans. Told each other?
Huh?
That like Shem told whoever and they just kept telling?
Yeah, Ham and Japheth. Ham went down went south down into what became Palestine. The Canaanites were descendants of Ham. The Egyptians, northern Africa, were all descendants of Ham. Japheth went west, so Europe, and went that way as well. So they spread out. The descendants of Shem went down into Iraq, but they also went into Iran, and they would bleed further beyond those areas. But there was oral tradition, and those stories would then be written about, talked about. The interesting thing about the flood stories is a number of them talk about how long the flood was after creation. And once again, there is less than when they said creation took place, the dating of that was all within 100 years of each other, of when they said creation was. And again, this is all over the world. Sort of interesting.
So the thought process in that day and age was to, at least before the flood, was to like rule and conquer. So like here in our society, we like to stay together as a family. So like Noah's family, like we're all pretty like within proximity. Oh, then their mentality was, this is free game. Let's go and conquer as much land as we can for ourselves. Was that
before the flood? You mean
after the flood? Well, before the flood, it was obviously all these different king civilizations, and then after the flood, it's been completely wiped out. So now you have 8 people.
Well, when I talked about those city states and all over and everything, like we're seeing on this map, this is after the flood.
Right, but those are descendants from the three,
right.
Three sons, so they didn't stick together and build one.
Shem, Ham, and Japheth did not stick together.
They wanted to just make their own name, right? Like that was kind of their mindset from before the flood, to make their own name, to make their own. Just trying to understand why they didn't stay together. Like, why did they disseminate? Why did they build such big? Why did they just have one big civilization within the family of Noah?
I don't know all the reasons why they chose to split up and everything, but they certainly did. I mean, we can trace the descendants of each one of them very clearly, very easily. A lot of the city names and everything are biblical names of those descendants. I mean, you can just tell where they went. So I don't know the motivations for all of that completely, but certainly there was a continual population growth, much, much greater than what we see today. We're going to get into it in just a minute in the Earth 3 Dynasty, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, okay? Good.
Could you say that like the Tower of Babel and God spreading the people is also a part of that doing, about the descendants? dissemination of the people group, because
yes.
they're all like the same people.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. After the flood, the king lists that we have from this period go back 1,000 years prior to Abraham, and they go, or 1,000 years before the flood, I should say, and then they pick up again around 3200, 3300 BC. These king lists, we start seeing them again, where they've grown back up. And
you said they pick up when?
3200, 3300 BC. The original, some of the king lists we have before the flood predate going back to 4000 BC, roughly. Okay. Abraham was born in 2166. The Ur III dynasty was from 2100 to 1900. He lived in Ur for 75 years. So he was there at the, was born and being raised. He was a man when the Ur III dynasty was at its height. And we want to talk about that now. Number four there in your notes.
Was the Ur III dynasty, 2100 to?
1900 BC. Yeah. So he was born just before that, but he was raised and in the height of that that dynasty. The culture of the Sumerians, and this is all during, the rest of this is all during that Ur III dynasty. So 2100 to 1900. What was life like for Abraham and Sarah as they grew up? What are things that they learned in their homeland where they grew up? Education, let's talk about that for just a second. There was a very sophisticated educational system. Boys would go to school from basically sunup to sundown until they were 12, 13 years of age, 14 years of age. From the time they could do much of anything, they would go to schools. We've unearthed schools. Not homeschooling, but schools, okay? Where they were educated. And these boys would be trained. We'll talk some more about what they were educated in. So formal education, number one there under schools. Tuition was paid for directly to the professor by families. So they would, a conglomerate of families would get together, they would hire a professor for their children, that professor reported directly to the parents. Okay? And if they weren't, if the professor was not doing a good enough job, the parents would basically let them go and hire somebody else if they weren't doing a good job. Yeah.
What sort of thing were they studying?
We're going to get into that.
Okay.
Great question. We're going to get into that. We have textbooks. We have classrooms. Some of the things we unearthed still had tablets sitting out in the classrooms. It's incredible. It's incredible. Okay, look at number two on the next page. School father. This is the school father or professor, the main teacher. Oversaw the class curriculum and student development, and his employment depended upon how well he did that. How much he got paid depended on how effective he was. Whether he kept his job depended on how effective he was. Parents had absolute control over this, and you can see it is not something that's being mandated by the state. It is something that parents thought was very important. It gives you some idea of the mindset of the Sumerians and here in the Ur III dynasty. By the way, in the Ur III dynasty, there were about 500,000 people in Sumer during that period of time. In that whole area of Sumer, which Ur is at the south part of that, 500,000 people in Sumer, 250,000 people in and around Ur. So it gives you some idea of the concentration down in that southern area. And if you'll notice, Ur was most likely, from all that we can tell and what we've unearthed, a coastal city at this point in time. Okay? Even though it's not now, it was back then. Then there was number three there, a school son or the student. There were usually anywhere from 10 to 30 students in a classroom. We can tell that because they would have documents that they would make that they would study, and we found up to 30 copies of the same document in the classroom. But most of them, it was around 12 to 15 students. 30 is the most we found. Most of them were around 12 to 15. Boys only. Sorry, ladies. That was their culture. And even within the students, they would have different roles. So if there were advanced students, they had responsibilities to help some of the less advanced students or some of the younger students and that sort of thing. So they functioned together very much. Then there was number four there, the big brother or the assistant professor. This was usually, in college, we would call this a graduate assistant. This was somebody who was more advanced, usually older in the classroom, probably closer to getting out of school, being done with school, but who was more advanced, and they would assist the professor in exchange for part of the tuition their parents would pay. The student would help the professor, and that would be sort of part of the family's pay to the professor and everything. And they were responsible for doing a couple of things. One was preparing the tablets that they would read from, or that they were going to make themselves each day. And we'll talk more about what that entailed in just a minute. But they were responsible for basically making sure the curriculum for the day was ready for the student. The professor would decide what it would be, give it to the assistant professor, and this advanced student would make sure that everybody had copies and everybody had what they needed for that day's class. There were art teachers. I'm not going to go into all that. They had a grammar teacher that would be brought in as well in many of the classrooms. There was number seven, one in charge of the whip. I wonder what they were for. What they were for.
Was it a teacher or a student?
I don't know. It was probably one of the older students, I'm guessing. But there was somebody who was designated one in charge of the whip. So whoever it was.
It's Jane for us, right?
Yeah, it's Jane. Okay.
It's a whipping. And when you said the art teacher, like, what did they, like, what were the teachers?
Well, drawing, artistic things, design, and that sort of thing. Let's get into the subjects now, okay? Cuneiform writing, this is what they would learn to write. The dating of these things. Write down pictographs under that.
Under dating?
Huh? Under dating. Pictographs. These pictographs. Pictographs predated what's called cuneiform. Pictographs, you can get the idea, were pictures that communicated something and everything. Pictographs became eventually more sophisticated and cuneiform writing. If you have ever looked at Chinese writing or even ancient Hebrew writing, they are forms of originally cuneiform, which came from pictographs as well. So every Hebrew letter of the alphabet represents an object of some sort in its original design. Huh?
Like hieroglyphics.
Very similar to hieroglyphics, yes. All of these have their roots going back to pictographs. In this area, it was called cuneiform writing was the next stage, where they actually started having more sophisticated kind of writing. And I'll show you that in just a second. The process, yeah, I just talked about that, cuneiform and all that. Look at the next page and you'll get an idea. Be easier if you just look at this page instead of the screen, okay? That's okay. You'll get a sense here. This was cuneiform writing. If you'll look at the letters that are here on the left-hand side of the page, you'll notice how they are sort of a wedge-shaped object that's making those. You'll see up above in the picture this stylus, and on one end, it's got a small wedge shape to it. On the other end, it's a larger wedge shape to it. And so you could flip it back and forth. What he's writing on is a 2-inch by 3-inch, basically, about this big piece of clay. And they would write on that with this stylus. They would impress. So when the assistant professor is preparing their tablets for writing lessons that day, what he is doing is getting, however many students there were, getting a number of these 2-inch by 3-inch pieces of clay out, rolled out, and ready to go for that day for them to write on and everything, okay? It would be relatively thin. It's not like it's big, thick piece of clay. It'd be relatively thin. He would roll it out pretty thin, and then they would practice their writing on it and come around and check their writing, see how they were doing in their writing of all this. The assistant professor was also responsible for preparing their reading lessons for the day. So what are they going to read? If they write on clay, what do they read? Well, they read from clay tablets as well. So how do you, did the assistant professor have to go through, and if there were 15 students in the class, create 15 copies of everything by hand? No, they were too sophisticated. I told you they were more engineering. They invented the Xerox machine. You think I'm kidding. You think I'm kidding. What they would do is that they would get a piece of stone and they would carve it into a cylinder that was 3 inches tall, 2 inches in circumference. And the assistant professor would chisel into that stone the lesson. Take a piece of clay, wrap it around, press it, unpeel it, there's one copy. Another piece of clay, wrap it around, press it, take it off, here's another copy. The first Xerox machine, okay? These cylinders, we found thousands of these cylinders that were created, creating these things in the classrooms and everything. We think about ancient people, you know, whether you believe in evolution or not, and I don't, for scientific reasons, besides biblical reasons, but for scientific reasons, I don't. But even if you don't believe in evolution, we tend to have an evolutionary mindset about mankind. We tend to think about the older people were, the less knowledgeable they were, the less sophisticated they were, the less bright they were, it was harder for them. They were just primitive in their thinking. Think about this. You've studied Adam and Eve. Science tells us today that most of us as human beings never use more than around 5% of our mental capacity. We never develop more than about and use more than about 5% of our mental capacity. I wonder how much mental capacity Adam and Eve used. Mm-hmm. Who were not, had no distortions to speak of, who didn't have a lot of distractions, who had a lot of time, who didn't have a lot of hobbies and other things to occupy their time and attention all the time. You think back about, they didn't have the sin buildup that we have today and all of that to the same extent. We just tend to think about people being cavemen-like, whether we believe in evolution or not. And I want to tell you, some of the most sophisticated things we do today still go back to ancient Sumeria. Okay, turn the page real quick. We're going to get into some more other subjects. The top of that page, it says the significance. I just want you to understand from what we've talked about and what we're going to talk about right now, Abraham was a very educated man. How educated was he? Let's look at this. What did they study? He was a boy who grew up in this culture that I'm talking about, where he went to school from the time he was capable of going to school until he was probably 13 or 14 years old. Every day, basically, 12 months out of the year, he was in school for all those years. They didn't get summer vacations and all that kind of stuff. From sunup to sundown, they were in school. What were the things they studied in literature? They studied poetry. And this was for educational purposes. Most of their educational, the way they learned things was from rote memory. They would memorize Kinglas. They would memorize the stories of the past. They would have to memorize them. But one of the ways that helped them to remember things was poetry. Poetry is more memorable. Let me ask you this. What do you remember best? The last paragraph you read from a textbook, or the last song that was on the radio? Why? It's catchy, it's more memorable, it involves more of our senses than just visual, just seeing. The same way is true of poetry. A lot of their poetry would be acrostic, it would be very memorable. Acrostic meaning, for us, the first line would start with the letter A, the second line with the letter B, the third with the letter B, C, etc. And they would sort of like, we sing ABCs, we teach children the alphabet by often singing the ABC song or something like that. I want you to think about it. He learned poetry. When you look at your Old Testament, is there any poetry there?
A ton
of poetry. Probably the most read portion of the Bible are the Psalms, which are all poetry, which have multiple acrostics within them. many of the Psalms are acrostics. Start with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the next, all the way through. Then they had proverbs, sayings, wise sayings from their forefathers that they would learn. Again, another form of poetry that they would have to learn and memorize and recite over and over again. They had histories that they read. Again, the king lists and those kinds of things. They would have to read those and memorize those. You're studying with Mike the history of the Old Testament. The first 16 books of the Bible are all histories. Abraham grew up with that same kind of thing. You had religious stories as well, a lot of them mythical stories. They had essays, and these were mainly political or moral kind of stories that they would have to read and study and discuss with one another. Much of it would be like some of the prophets that we read in the Old Testament, in terms of how life and religion were relating to one another. And you got the prophets speaking to the kings, and how the kings treated the prophets and whether they listened or didn't listen. How the prophets were speaking truth and morality into the political realm and that sort of thing. And these essays that they read had a lot of that in it as well. Then they had farmers' almanacs as well, the farmers' almanacs. It would tell them how to plant their crops during certain seasons of the cycles of the ecological things that were going on during that decade. Or whatever. If you read when you get to the book of Leviticus, much of the book of Leviticus does the same kinds of things that their farmer's almanac did. How to avoid disease, how to cure things, how to take care of this or that or the other in this farmer's almanac. Let's look at mathematics. This is where it gets really intriguing. How many of you have studied square roots? Yes.
No.
You can thank the Sumerians, who were the first ones to talk about that. They passed it on to the Persians eventually, to the north, the Greeks, the Romans, all the way to us today. How many of you have studied geometry? Rooted in the Sumerians. They are the first ones that we have records of, where they developed a lot of the formulas that are used in geometry and in trigonometry were developed all the way back to the Sumerians.
That's cool.
Okay? The sexagesimal system.
What did they use them for?
They were engineers. So when they were trying to figure out how to get elevations in canals, they were using geometry. When they tried to figure out how to get buildings level for the flood season so they wouldn't be suspect for that. How high do you have to build the threshold of your house so that it doesn't get flooded in the flood season? Well, the river's a mile away. How do I know how they would use geometry to figure out how high it was here compared to over there? They would use all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh.
Is sexagesimal like hexadecimal in a way? In a way of numbering for writing purposes?
Not quite. Okay. Not quite. The sexagesimal system, they were fascinated with the number 6. And that's where it comes from. Now, we can look at that and laugh and say, what has that got to do? That's not very important. I want you to think about the world in which we live today when it comes to mathematics, okay? And how we number things today. How many months in a year?
12.
On average, how many days in a month?
30.
In their day, every month had 30 days. Okay. How many inches in a foot?
12.
Divisible by 6. Mm-hmm. How many degrees in a full circle?
360.
Divisible by 6. All of those came from the Sumerians. All of those measurements that we use today came from the Sumerians. They were fascinated with all of that. They had 30 days in a month, 12 months, 360 days. You're studying Old Testament history right now with Mike. I want you to realize from the time of Abraham all the way through the rest of the Old Testament, 360 days in a year is how they measured that. 30 days in a month. Where did they get that? Abraham just brought it from Sumeria. And all the way through the history of Israel, that's how they measured time. That's how they measured the seasons by the months and that sort of thing as well. Now when we get to the New Testament, the Romans revise it a little bit in terms of the dating, but that's where it all got started. Now, did the Sumerians not realize that there were 365 and a quarter days in a year? No, they realized that perfectly. Just every few years, they would have a month-long holiday and make up, and they would start all over again.
So they had their own version of leap year.
That's right. They had their own version of leap year.
That's awesome.
Party!
Okay.
Let's go back to that.
And yeah. Forget leap year. Who needs that?
One day. We don't know.
So it's leap month.
Okay. Even think about time, how we tell time. How many hours in a day?
24.
Yeah. And everything goes back to this sexagesimal system that the Sumerians, all of that goes back to that. The dating. Again, the Romans eventually will alternate that during the days of Augustus Caesar when Christ is born. He reestablishes some things, but it's still basically the same thing in terms of roughly the same ideas. Still have 12 months and everything. Uh-huh.
What about octals?
Octals. That's not
so
Sumerian.
24 hours in a day, it's still divisible by 8. That's not Sumerian?
No. They were strictly sexagesimal. Yeah. Yeah. Again, they were fascinated with the number 6 for some reason. I don't know why. Other subject they said, yeah.
Sorry if I'm repeating a question, but is this related in any way to man's number kind of thing? Is that
no.
just kind of a...
No, I don't meeting? Think so. If it is, I have no idea why, or we would have no... support for that one way or the other. Look at the other subjects that Abraham studied. Botany. When you get to Genesis chapter 21, you're going to see Abraham is in Beersheba, and he plants a tamarisk tree. What is a tamarisk tree? Where is he planting it? He's planting it in the heart of the desert. Tree. Barren. No trees out there. Bushes at the best. Scraggly bushes at the best. And he plants a tamarisk tree. Now then, if you go to Israel and you go to Beersheba, you will find tamarisk trees everywhere. They are not indigenous to Israel. You know where they're indigenous from?
Sumeria.
Abraham knew how to grow things in a desert. He knew the tamarisk tree was a tree that would put out a taproot that could go as far as 160 feet deep in search of water. And it could last live for hundreds of years. It was slow growing, but it would always be there, so to speak. And it was also something that you could get what was called manna from.
What?
It gets a dew on it overnight. As the sun comes up, the dew that is formed on the leaf of the tamarisk tree, they blend together, and the leaf secretes, the dew rests on it. As the sun comes up, it dries it out and creates a white flaky substance that they still to this day call manna.
Does it okay? taste like honey?
I don't know what it tastes like, but it is something you can take your finger and eat in the middle of the desert.
Let's freaking go.
No rain. Okay?
Let's go to the desert.
Zoology. They would study zoology, how to take care of a sort of an animal husbandry, how to take care of half cattle.
God, that's not so good.
When Abraham and his father leave Ur of the Chaldees to go to a land that God will show him, notice what they take with them. They are taking herds of animals. How do you take care of them on a trip? How do you take these large herds of cattle, sheep and goats and cows, how do you take all of that with you and feed them and take care of them on a long trip like this? Abraham knew how. He was raised that way. Mineralogy, geography, he knew. Why did he follow the Fertile Crescent? How did he know to do that? And where there would be water all the way along. How to make pottery and how to use it. How to make pots that could go from going down to the river and gathering water and carrying it back to your house to putting it, this cold water in this pot on a fire and the pottery would not crack. How did you do that? They learned how to make different kinds of pottery for different kinds of purposes. They studied theology. A couple other things. They studied astronomy, how to read the stars and everything, how to navigate by the stars. Many of the Orion and the names we have for different constellations of stars go back to ancient Mesopotamia. Okay? And they studied those things and the movement of the stars. Where did the wise men following the star come from? From ancient Mesopotamia.
Of course they did.
Of course they did. Okay. The last area was warfare and military tactics. Was another subject. You're going to get to Genesis 14. Four kings from the east are going to follow the Fertile Crescent around, back from basically where Abraham had come from. They're going to follow the Fertile Crescent, come down through modern-day Jordan and, not Jordan, but modern-day Syria and Lebanon, down into modern-day Israel, and they were going to go to the other side of the river, and they were going to take several, these four kings and their armies were going to take several cities, whole cities, and take them into captivity, and they were taking them back through that same route, back home again. Lot and his family were a part of that. Abraham hears what has happened. Abraham takes his army. Oh, wait a minute. He doesn't have an army. Abraham takes his farmhands, and he goes and defeats four kings and their armies up in northern Israel. Now we can say, well, God was with him and God helped him to do that. That's very true. That's very true. But guess who was trained in military warfare? Guess who served in the military for 2 years, mandatory? Every boy did. Served in the after he after you turn 13 and 14, you're out of school. 2 years mandatory in the army. The Sumerians were not a warring people, but they had to learn how to defend themselves. You go to Israel today, same thing. Every boy, when he gets done with school, mandatory military. Every girl, not quite as long as the boys, but it's still mandatory military to this day. That sounds awfully familiar to the Sumerians, but it's all rooted going back to Abraham and what he learned back there. He learned military tactics. He was able to train as you go through, notice how many times Abraham and his ranch, his holdings are attacked, are threatened. He had to learn, had to train his people to defend themselves. And he trained them in military tactics just like he had been trained. And they were able to go and defeat four generals and their armies from the east. The religion was polytheism. As you're going through the Old Testament history, you're going to get to Joshua 24. Notice what it says there. And Joshua said to all the people, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods," plural. That is the context in which Abraham was brought up in Ur of the Chaldees. They were very polytheistic, worshipped other gods. And here is the God of the universe calling Abraham, as you're going to see in chapter 12, to leave Ur and go to a land that I will show you.
Do you think that Abraham would have been polytheist at the time until God like interacted with him?
So the question is, do I think Abraham would have been polytheistic at the time until God called him? We don't have any indication that he was. Okay? We do of Terah, his father, but not of Abraham.
Yeah.
From Joshua, we see that about Terah. But there's no indication that Abraham ever believed in anything else. Let me get through a little bit here real quick on this religion particularly. Notice on the top of page 7, religious temples, or this is a ziggurat that you see there in that picture, that graphic. They did not have stone to speak of, not much. It wasn't plentiful. What they had was clay, and they could make bricks. So most of their structures were made out of clay. You will notice the walls of this city, if you look carefully, the walls are larger at the bottom and they move up. They're sort of tapered up. And that's, again, because of what they're building with. You can't just stack brick for a long, tall structures that are going to be defensible straight up. They needed to be like this because you couldn't have too much weight on the bottom or it would start crumbling. So it had to get lighter and lighter as it went up. So they were tapered up. All the walls were slightly tapered and everything. The whole idea of, the things that were most important, these ziggurats, would always be in the center of a city-state. They would be surrounded by the wall of the city. I mean, much further around, but they were always within the walls of the city, which were designed to protect from the floody season, the rainy season, the floods that would come, as well as the ziggurat had its own built-in protection from the floods that would come. So you would have very high thresholds. You might have to go up several steps and then down several steps to get into a structure, depending on where it was located from the river and everything. Some of them, like this ziggurat, at some of the ziggurats, you had to go up to the second story to get down to the first story. You can see the stairwells there. You don't see any doors in this particular ziggurat on the first floor, the first level. You have to go up the stairs into a door, and then you can go back down. Again, to protect them from both floods and from attack. So these ziggurats would be used, this would be the center, this would be their city hall. This would be their library. This would be the focal point of religious worship. This ziggurat would be the centerpiece of the city-state. We have the ruins, the foundation of the ziggurat in Ur. This picture right here is a recreation from the footing that we have there in Ur of that ziggurat, what they were like.
Are some of these still standing today?
Not standing, no. But we do have the footings of them and the base of some of them, like in Ur, that they can reproduce. And we have pictures of them from their artwork and stuff as well, so we knew what they looked like. And there were descriptions about what their rooms were like, what were in them, that sort of thing. So we have a lot of that information. The very top room, if you'll notice on the top of this ziggurat, there is one small room up there. That was referred to as the throne room. The throne room. And it was empty. And it had a throne in it. You ought to write down next to this Isaiah chapter 14, verses 13 and 14.
Isaiah what?
Chapter 14, verses 13 and 14. These are words of Satan in his rebellion against God. This is what he says in his heart as he rebels against God. And one of the statements there is, I will build my throne above the throne of God. I will build my throne into the clouds. The ziggurats were the highest structure that you could build in this part of the world. And it's got an empty throne room on the top. Okay? Now, I don't know that that was for Satan. But there is no record of any other use of that room whatsoever. It was just an empty throne room.
Do you think the sixth adjustment system that Sumerians used had anything to do with like the number of the beast?
Could be. I just don't know that for sure, but it could be. It's the number, the last thing here, they had a lot of state gods, personal gods, but the last thing I want to tell you about here under this, and we got to get out of here. During this Ur III dynasty, emperor worship or king worship was introduced for the first time in Ur, to where the king became a god that was to be worshipped. Polytheism is a religion that says there are many gods and we ought to worship these gods, or these are gods that are there, and you would be encouraged to worship them. King worship demanded. Their king worship was demanding that. I wonder if the way it was going in Ur, polytheism, but now then also king, mandatory king worship, where you had to worship the king. So if Abraham believed in the one true God in the midst of a polytheistic society, that was okay because he was still worshiping a god from the other people's perspective. But now then, if king worship is introduced where you have to worship the king and he doesn't worship that king, what happens? Okay? I wonder if this has anything to do with God, why God removed him from Ur and took him to a new land. And everything that you're going to study. Let me pray. We'll get out of here. Father, thank you so much. Thank you so much for giving us the privilege, just a little bit of insight through all the archaeology and all the discoveries there in modern-day Iraq. We hear so many stories about things going on in Iraq today that are horrifying to us. And yet, before all of this, you have allowed us to discover things that are so helpful in understanding the scriptures. And we thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.
Is the Tower of Babel a cigarette?
Many believe it was.